Disc 5.
The dawn of May the 6th revealed an ugly scene. The wind was blowing nearly 50 knots from the northwest, and the Caird was straining into it, trying to hold to a northeasterly course. As every wave passed, some portion of it poured on board the boat. But it seemed really not to matter too much. They'd been pounded and bruised and drenched almost to the point of insensibility. For 13 days they had suffered through almost ceaseless gales. Then finally, a huge rogue sea. But sufficiently provoked, there is hardly a creature on God's earth that ultimately won't turn and attempt to fight, regardless of the odds. In an unspoken sense, that was much the way they felt now. They were possessed by an angry determination to see the journey through, no matter what. As if to mock their determination, though, the sea rose menacingly throughout the morning. By noon it had grown so treacherous that Shackleton felt it was foolhardy to press on, though Worsley urged him to do so. At 1 o'clock, Shackleton gave the order to heave to. They came about and dropped the sail. All of them fell sullen. Even Shackleton, who from the beginning had required of the men that they make every effort to remain cheerful in order to avoid antagonisms. But it seemed too much to be so close and to have to stop. The afternoon passed without incident until almost dusk, when Crean started to prepare the evening hoosh. A minute or two later, he called for Shackleton to come below. Crean handed him a mug of water to taste, and Shackleton took a small sip. Then a grave expression came over his face. The water was foul. It had the unmistakable brackish taste of sea water that apparently had seeped into the cask. Crean asked Shackleton what he should do, and Shackleton rather snappishly replied that there was obviously nothing they could do. It was the only water they had, and they would have to use it. Crean went ahead and made the hoosh. When it was ready, the men sampled it cautiously and found that it was disagreeably salty. For Shackleton, the discovery meant simply that the need for haste had now become acute. Their food should last 2 weeks, but they had less than 1 week's supply of water, and that was brackish. Thus, a landing had to be made, and soon. The inevitable question then became, would they hit South Georgia? Except for one or two tiny islands, the Atlantic Ocean eastward beyond South Georgia is a void all the way to South Africa, nearly 3,000 miles away. If, through a miscalculation or because of a southerly gale, they missed the island, there would be no second chance. The land would then lie to windward of them, and they could never beat back toward it. They dared not miss. By Worsley's estimate, they should have been a little more than 50 miles off the coast, but Worsley's calculations were admittedly crude due to the fog, and they could easily have been much closer. On the west coast of South Georgia, there was not the smallest settlement, much less a beacon light or even a buoy to guide them. Thus it was entirely conceivable that they might come upon the coast in the dark, suddenly and disastrously. The men peered into the night with salt-rimmed eyes for the shadowy image of a headland, and they strained their ears for any unusual noise, perhaps the sound of surf pounding on a reef. Gradually, the hours crept by, though there was nothing to indicate that they were nearing the coast. At 4 a.m, when Worsley's watch came on, Shackleton remained with him at the helm to keep a lookout for the land. They were making about 3 knots, and by 6 o'clock they should have been less than 15 miles offshore. But there was not a sign of it. Not the smallest bit of ice or shred of seaweed. The air of anticipation was slowly being replaced by a feeling of increasing tension. Some of the peaks on South Georgia were nearly 10,000 feet high. Surely they would be visible by now. At 8 o'clock, Shackleton's watch was due to take over, but nobody thought about watches. Instead, all hands crowded into the cockpit, searching ahead and to each side in an atmosphere of competition, of hoping, of anxiety. But there was only the sea and the sky, just the same as there had always been. Toward 9 o'clock, Shackleton sent Crean below to prepare some hoosh. When it was ready, they ate it hurriedly in order to return to their lookout posts. was a strange time, a time of eagerness and expectation, underscored by grave, unspoken doubts. It was all so nearly over, an occasion for excitement, even jubilation. And yet in the back of their minds was a nagging voice that refused to be silent. They might very well be looking in vain. If the island was there, they should have sighted it hours before. Then at just after 10:30, Vincent spotted a clump of seaweed, and a few minutes later a cormorant was sighted overhead. Hope flared anew. Cormorants rarely ventured farther than 15 miles from land. Soon the foggy mists began to break up, though ever so slowly. At noon, the fog was gone, but the interminably heaving sea stretched in every direction. "Land!" It was McCarthy's voice, strong and confident. He was pointing dead ahead, and there it was, a black, frowning cliff, patches of snow clinging to its sides. It was just visible below the clouds, possibly 10 miles away. A moment later, the clouds moved like a curtain across the water, shutting off the view. But no matter, it was there, and they had all seen it. Shackleton was the only one who spoke. "We've done it," he said, and his voice was strangely steady. Not a sound came from the others. They simply stared ahead, watching for the land to reappear, just to be sure. And in a minute or two, when the clouds had blown away again, it did. Feeble, foolish grins spread across their faces, not of triumph or even joy, but simply of unspeakable relief. They held the cairn on a course straight for the point they had first seen, and within an hour they were close enough to make out the general contour of the land. Worsley took out his notebook and drew a rough sketch of it. He then compared it with the chart, and it appeared to correspond to the area of Cape Demidov. If so, it meant that his navigation had been very nearly faultless. They were only about 16 miles from the western tip of the island, the point for which they had originally been aiming. By 2:30, the cairn was a little more than 3 miles off the coast, and it was possible to see patches of green lichens and areas of yellow-brown tussock grass showing through the snow on the steep sides of the headlands. Everything seemed perfect. But not for long. Within a few minutes, the deep rumbling sound of breakers reached them. Then, dead ahead and off to the right, an occasional spout of bursting spray shot skyward. The whole complexion of things was suddenly changed. There could be no thought of a landing, not here at least, for the boat would not have lived 10 seconds in those breakers. It was something they didn't deserve, a needless cruelty. The land lay just in front of them, and they had earned it. Yet now that the journey was done, sanctuary was ironically denied them. A decision had to be made quickly. If the point ahead was Cape Demidov, their chart showed two possibilities of finding shelter. One was King Haakon Bay, some 10 miles east along the coast to starboard. The other was Wilson Harbour, just to the north of the point for which they were now making. But King Haakon Bay lay in a generally east-west position and was therefore almost totally exposed to the northwesterly wind that was blowing. Furthermore, it would take them until night even to reach its entrance, and whatever reefs guarded the opening would have to be negotiated in the dark. Wilson Harbour, though it was only about 4 miles away, unfortunately lay just enough to windward to put it out of reach, in view of the sea that was running. Consequently, although there were two theoretical choices, there was really none worthy of the risk. By 3 o'clock, the land was only 2 miles distant. They could easily have reached it in less than 45 minutes. But they would have died doing so. Thus, at 3:10 p.m., Shackleton gave the order to come about. They swung onto the starboard tack and headed seaward once again, to lay off until morning, in the hope that they could then make a better approach or perhaps find a way through the reefs. Hardly any one of them spoke. Individually, they were fighting somehow to console their awful disappointment. Crean prepared some hoosh, but they were nearing the bottom of the spoiled cask and the food seemed particularly foul. A deliberate effort was required to swallow it. The wind had an ominous sound, and it was rising with every hour. At 8 o'clock, rain began to fall. Before long, the rain turned into sleet, then hail that drummed across the decking. By 11 p.m, the storm had reached gale force, and the Caird was caught in a cross sea that drove in from every direction, hurling the boat one way, then slamming her another. They ran before the quartering gale until midnight, and though they had not the slightest idea where they might be, Shackleton decided they must be far enough offshore to heave to. The long wait for daybreak was begun. The dawn of May the 9th finally came, but there was no real dawn. Instead, the wild blackness of the night slowly gave way to a thick grey pall. Only an estimate could be made of the wind's actual speed, though it was at least 65 knots. The cross sea was the worst it had been, and added to it, there was now a mountainous westerly swell sweeping inland before the gale. Visibility was reduced to a hazy sphere surrounding the boat, and though they had not the vaguest idea where they might be, they knew one thing all too well. Somewhere off to leeward, the black cliffs of South Georgia were waiting, steadfastly hurling back this colossal onslaught of water. They wished they knew how far. The Caird's bow was kept pointed into the wind, but it was astern that they looked, trying to catch a glimpse of the island or the treacherous reefs that had kept them at bay the previous afternoon. Then, at just about 2 o'clock, they saw where they were. A quirk of wind tore the clouds apart, and two wicked peaks loomed above a line of cliffs and the perpendicular faces of glaciers that dropped sheer into the sea. The coastline looked to be about a mile away, perhaps a little more. But vastly more important, in that single glimpse, they saw to their terror that they were only a short distance outside the line of breakers, the point at which the seas ceased to behave like swells and became combers instead, rushing faster and faster toward their own destruction against the land. As each swell passed under them, they could feel it tugging momentarily at the boat, trying to get hold of her and hurl her toward the beach. It seemed now that everything, the wind, the current, and even the sea itself, were united in a single determined purpose, once and for all, to annihilate this tiny boat. No choice remained but to hoist sail and try to claw their way offshore into the teeth of this fiendish gale. Shackleton pulled the Caird's bow around to the southeast, and the wind, like a solid object, struck her a shuddering blow that all but capsized her. Shackleton shouted excitedly to McNeish and Vincent below to shift ballast. They, kneeling on the rocks and working as feverishly as their strength permitted, piled the boulders against the starboard side, and the Caird righted herself somewhat. She moved forward half a boat length before the first sea struck her and stopped her dead. Solid water was flung over the masthead, and the strain was so great that her bow planks opened up and little lines of water squirted in through the seams. Once more she moved ahead, and once more the sea clubbed her to a halt. Over and over again the process was repeated, until it seemed certain that she would burst her planking or have the masts torn out of her. The water now was coming in both from above and below. It was rising so fast that two men, working constantly, could not handle it. So Shackleton put all hands to the task, three men on the pump and one bailing with the 2-gallon hoosh pot. That left one man to relieve whoever showed the first signs of exhaustion. But for all their efforts, they seemed only to be standing still. Occasionally the clouds were ripped aside, revealing the coast off the port quarter, just as close as ever. After more than an hour, they had demonstrated the truth of what they first suspected. It could not be done. No boat could beat to windward in such a storm. Shackleton was sure the end was very near. But actually, they were making headway. Gauged against the indistinct outline of the coast, it was imperceptible, but it was real, nonetheless. They became aware of it suddenly just after 4 o'clock, when a rift in the storm showed a great craggy peak off the port bow. It was Anenkoff Island. a 2,000-foot mountaintop shoved up out of the sea some 5 miles off the coast, and they realized at once that it lay directly in their path. Though the Caird's bow was pointed well to seaward, she was powerless to prevent the gale from driving her downwind. Thus her actual course was more sideways than forward. Nor was there any way to turn. Astern lay the coast, and the chart showed that off to port was a successive line of reefs. Only to starboard was there open sea, and that was surely the direction she could not go, for that was the direction from which the wind was blowing. There was nothing to do, therefore, but to hold to the southeasterly course as close into the wind as possible, and pray God that somehow she could edge by the island, if she held together that long. Neither was at all likely. By now it was getting dark, though the sky was somewhat clearer, and Anenkoff Island was plainly visible. The sheer mass of it now dominated everything to leeward. The sound of the seas against its side virtually drowned out even the screaming of the wind. The foaming backwash of the breakers thrown back from the cliffs swirled around the Caird, and the towering, snowy peak above them was so close they had to crane their necks to see it. Worsley thought to himself of the pity of it all. He remembered the diary he had kept ever since the Endurance had sailed from South Georgia almost 17 months before. That same diary, wrapped in rags and utterly soaked, was now stowed in the forepeak of the Caird. When she went, it would go too. Worsley thought not so much of dying, because that was now so plainly inevitable, but of the fact that no one would ever know how terribly close they had come. He waited at the helm, braced for the final shattering impact, when the Caird's bottom would be torn out against some unseen rock. As he watched, the sky to the east crept into view. "She's clearing it!" he screamed. "She's clearing it!" The bailers stopped, and everybody looked up and saw the stars shining to leeward. The island was no longer in the way. They had no idea how, even why, perhaps some unexpected eddy of the tide had driven them offshore. But no one then stopped to seek an explanation. They knew only one thing. The boat had been spared. All at once they felt inexpressibly weary, numb, even indifferent. The gale, too, appeared exhausted by the struggle, or perhaps it knew that it had lost, for the wind rapidly died off. They came about and set a course for the northwest, giving South Georgia a wide berth. The sea was still high, but the viciousness had gone out of it. They had to continue to bail almost until midnight before they had reduced the Caird's burden of water to the extent that 3 men could handle it. Then Worsley's watch was sent below to get some sleep, while Shackleton, Crean, and McNeish remained on duty. At 3:30, Worsley's watch took over, and towards 7 o'clock, South Georgia came into view again, about 10 miles off to starboard. They set a course straight for the land, but the wind shifted to the northwest and fell very light. Thus, throughout the morning, their progress was steady, but painfully slow. At noon, they were almost abeam of Cape Demidoff once more, and dead ahead were 2 inviting glaciers which held the promise of ice to be melted into water. But it was evident that they could not reach them before dark. Consequently, they came about to head for King Haakon Bay. For 20 minutes they made good progress, but then the damnable wind swung around to head them off, blowing from the east, straight out of the bay. The sails were lowered, and with Shackleton at the helm, the other men took turns rowing 2 at a time. Before long, the tide turned and began to set to the south, thus aiding the wind in keeping them offshore. However, by 3 o'clock they had managed to pull close enough to see relatively calm water in the bay beyond the reefs, and they also saw what appeared to be a safe passage. But they could not possibly get through before dark, not under oars. It was time for a last desperate attempt. Another night, this time without a drop of water, and possibly another gale. They simply did not have it in them. Hurriedly, they ran up every sail to its full height and headed for the narrow opening in the reefs. But it meant sailing straight into the wind, and the Caird simply could not do it. Four times they lay off, and four times they tried to tack into the wind. Four times they failed. It was well after 4 o'clock, and the light was beginning to go. They ran the Caird a mile to the south, trying to get the wind as much abeam as possible. Then they came about once more onto the starboard tack. This time she just managed to slip through. Instantly the sails were dropped and the oars were put out. They rowed for about 10 minutes. Then Shackleton spotted a small cove in the cliffs to starboard. The entrance was protected by a small reef of its own, over which the surge of the swell was breaking, but they saw an opening, though it was so small the oars had to be taken in at the last moment. About 200 yards beyond was a steep, bouldered beach. Shackleton stood in the bow, holding the frayed remains of the sea anchor line. Finally, the Caird rose up on a swell, and her keel ground against the rocks. Shackleton jumped ashore and held her from going out. As quickly as they could, the other men scrambled after him. They heard a trickling sound. Only a few yards away, a little stream of fresh water was running down from the glaciers high above. A moment later, all six were on their knees, drinking. It was a curiously quiet moment, almost devoid of rejoicing. They had accomplished the impossible, but at a staggering price. Now it was over, and they knew only that they were unutterably tired, too tired even to savour much more than the dim awareness that they had won. They managed, however, to shake hands all around. It seemed, somehow, the thing to do. It was 5 o'clock on the 10th of May, 1916, and they were standing, at last, on the island from which they had sailed 522 days before. Yet even in that small moment of victory, tragedy threatened. The surf inside the cove was especially heavy. It had swung the Caird's stern around, and she was pounding against the rocks. They stumbled back down the beach, but the rocks were rough and their legs were rubbery with weakness. By the time they reached the boat, her rudder had already been torn off. She had to be raised clear of the water, and that meant unloading her. So they formed themselves into a chain and began the laborious job of passing the stores up the beach. But when it came time to get the Caird onto safer ground, the real extent of their weakness became evident. Exerting every ounce of their combined strength, they could hardly do more than rock the boat back and forth. And after about 6 tries, Shackleton saw that it was no use to continue until they had rested and had something to eat. A piece of light rope was made fast to the Caird's bow and secured to a boulder. They left the boat at the water's edge, pounding against the rocks. What appeared to be a small cave had been sighted about 30 yards off to the left, and they dragged their sleeping bags and a small amount of stores up to it. They crawled inside and found that the cave was about 12 feet deep, with ample room to shelter them. Crean lit a fire and prepared some hoosh. It was 8 o'clock by the time they had finished eating, and Shackleton instructed all of them to turn in, saying that they would stand one man watches over the Caird. He agreed to take the first. The others crawled into their wet but blissfully motionless sleeping bags, and within seconds they were truly unconscious. Everything went well until about 2 a.m. Tom Crean was on watch when a particularly heavy sea caught the Caird and she broke loose. Crean managed to grab the bowline and he shouted for help, but by the time the others had awakened and made their way down to the beach, Crean had been dragged into the water almost over his head. With all of them pulling, they managed to bring her back to shore, and they tried once more to get her up the beach, this time by rolling her over. Again, they lacked the strength. They were very close to exhaustion, but even their desperate craving for sleep could not be considered when weighed against the possible loss of the boat. Shackleton decided they would have to watch her until daylight. They sat down to wait for morning, but there was no sleep because periodically they had to fend the Caird off the rocks. Shackleton reviewed their situation in his mind. He had originally hoped to use this place only as a stopover to replenish their water and to obtain a few days' rest, then press on around the coast to Leith Harbour. But the Caird's rudder was now lost. Furthermore, if they were to have rest, the boat had to be pulled clear of the water. To do so, they would have to lighten her by removing the decking, since they lacked the strength to lift her as she was. Once that was done, she would hardly be fit to face the sea again. Sitting on the rocks, waiting for morning, Shackleton came to the conclusion that instead of sailing to Leith Harbour, they would remain on the south side of the island, and three of the party would go overland to bring help. By sea, it would have been a voyage of more than 130 miles out around the western tip of the island and then along the north coast. By land, it was a scant 29 miles in a straight line. The only difference between the two was that in the three quarters of a century that men had been coming to South Georgia, not one man had ever crossed the island, for the simple reason that it could not be done. A few of the peaks on South Georgia rise to somewhat less than 10,000 feet, which certainly is not high by mountain climbing standards. But the interior of the island has been described by one expert as a sawtooth thrust through the tortured upheaval of mountain and glacier that falls in chaos to the northern sea. In short, it was impassable. Shackleton knew it, and yet there was no choice. He made his announcement after breakfast, and all of the men accepted it routinely and without question. Shackleton said he would make the journey with Worsley and Crean as soon as it seemed feasible, but there was work to be done first. McNeish and McCarthy were put to the task of removing the decking and the extra planks from the Caird, while Shackleton, Crean and Worsley went to work levelling the floor of the cave with some loose stones and dry tussock grass. By noon, McNeish had dismantled enough of the Caird's upper works to lighten her considerably, so they decided to attempt to get her up. They shoved her up the beach, literally by inches, pausing every few minutes to rest. She was safely above the high water mark by 1 o'clock. Later in the afternoon, Shackleton and Crean climbed a plateau at the head of the cove, and there they saw mounds of white among the rocks. These proved to be baby albatrosses on the nest. Shackleton went back for the shotgun, and they killed one adult and one chick. They ate them for supper. Afterwards they turned in and slept for 12 glorious hours without a single interruption. By morning they all felt infinitely better. Shackleton and Worsley, meanwhile, had made a survey of sorts around the area and saw that it was very nearly impenetrable country. Except for the cove in which they were camped, the cliffs and glaciers rose almost perpendicularly. Consequently, Shackleton decided they would sail the Caird to the head of King Haakon Bay, a distance of about 6 miles. Their chart indicated that the terrain there was somewhat more hospitable, and they would also be 6 miles closer to Stromness Bay, on the opposite side of the island where the whaling stations were situated. Short as this journey was, Shackleton felt the men were not yet equal to it, so they spent 2 days recuperating and eating sumptuously. Little by little, as they gained strength and the tension went out of their nerves, a marvellous feeling of security came over all of them, dimmed only by the knowledge of the responsibility they bore to the castaways back on Elephant Island. May the 14th had been the day set for the trip to the head of the bay, but the weather in the morning was squally with rain, so the trip was postponed until the following day. In the afternoon, there were encouraging signs of clearing. They were up at dawn the following morning. The Caird was loaded and easily shoved downhill into the water. She had cleared the cove and entered the open bay at 8 o'clock. A brisk northwesterly wind was blowing, and before long the sun broke through the clouds. It was an utterly carefree journey, as the Caird drove smartly across the sparkling water. After a while, they even began to sing. It occurred to Shackleton that they could easily have been mistaken for a picnic party out for a lark, except, perhaps, for their woebegone appearance. Shortly past noon, they rounded a high bluff, and before them lay a sheltered, gently sloping beach of sand and pebbles. It was populated by hundreds of sea elephants, enough to keep them supplied with food and fuel indefinitely. They were ashore by 12:30. The cad was hauled above the reach of the water, and then they turned her over. McCarthy shored her up with a foundation of stones, and when she was ready, they arranged their sleeping bags inside. It was decided to name the place Peggotty Camp, after the poor but honest family in Dickens' David Copperfield. Shackleton was extremely anxious to begin the journey. However, the next day, May the 16th, dawned cloudy and rainy, keeping them confined under the cad nearly all day. They spent the time discussing the journey, and McNeish busied himself fixing their boots for climbing. He had removed 4 dozen 2-inch screws from the cad, and he fixed 8 of them into each shoe to be worn by the members of the overland party. Again on May the 17th, the weather was not fit for travel, with squally winds and sleet blowing. Worsley went with Shackleton to the east, toward the extreme head of the bay, to reconnoitre inland as much as possible. It was not a very successful mission due to the poor visibility. May the 18th was another day of disagreeable weather, and Shackleton was almost beside himself to begin the journey. They spent a tense day going over their gear once more and watching for a break in the weather. The decision had been made to travel light, even without sleeping bags. Each of the overland party was to carry his own allotment of 3 days' sledging rations and biscuits. In addition, they were to take a filled Primus stove, which carried enough fuel for 6 meals, plus a small pot for cooking, and a half-filled box of matches. They had 2 compasses, a pair of binoculars, and about 50 feet of rope knotted together, along with the carpenter's adze for use as an ice axe. The only superfluous item Shackleton permitted was Worsley's diary. At dusk, the break came. The sky showed signs of clearing. Shackleton met with McNeish, whom he was leaving in charge of the 3 men staying behind. Shackleton gave him his final instructions, and he wrote this letter in McNeish's diary. May the 18th, 1916, South Georgia. Sir, I am about to try to reach Husvik on the east coast of this island for relief of our party. I am leaving you in charge of the party consisting of Vincent, McCarthy, and yourself. You will remain here until relief arrives. You have ample seal food, which you can supplement with birds and fish according to your skill. You also have all the necessary equipment to support life for an indefinite period in the event of my non-return. You had better, after winter is over, try and sail around to the east coast. The course I am making towards Husvik is east magnetic. I trust to have you relieved in a few days. Yours faithfully, E. H. Shackleton. The others turned in, but Shackleton could not sleep, and he went outside repeatedly to check on the weather. It was clearing, but only very slowly. Worsley, too, got up about midnight to see how conditions were. However, by 2 a.m., the moon was shining down brilliantly, and the air was wonderfully clear. Shackleton said the time had come. It took only a few minutes to gather up their meagre equipment. Then they shook hands all around, and Shackleton, Worsley, and Crean crawled out from under the cad. The 3 men made their way along the shoreline to the head of the bay, then started upland, climbing a fairly steep, snow-covered slope. Shackleton was in the lead, and he set a brisk pace. For the first hour or so, they trudged upward without a pause. But the snow underfoot was soft to about ankle depth, and they soon began to feel the strain in their legs. Fortunately, when they reached a height of about 2,500 feet, the slope levelled off. On the chart they carried, only the coastline of South Georgia was shown, and a great deal of that was missing. The interior was blank. Thus they could be guided only by what they could see. But about 5 a.m., a thick fog rolled in, shrouding everything in a diffused glow of luminescence, in which even the snow beneath their feet was real only when they set foot on it. Shackleton thought it would be best if they roped themselves together for safety. As the sun rose higher, the fog began to thin out. Peering ahead, they saw an enormous snow-covered lake, just slightly to the left of their easterly course. The lake was a rare bit of good luck, because it promised the opportunity of a level route across its entire length, and they started toward it. For an hour they followed an easy downhill route, though there was an increasing number of crevasses. At first, these were thin and shallow, but before long they grew wider and deeper, and it soon became apparent that the three men were descending the face of a glacier. It was an unusual situation, because glaciers rarely emptied into lakes. And yet there it was, stretching invitingly before them. By 7 o'clock, the sun had risen high enough to burn away the last traces of fog, and they suddenly saw that the lake extended all the way to the horizon. They were marching toward Possession Bay, the open sea, on the northern coast of South Georgia. They had, in fact, covered about 7 miles and almost crossed the island at a narrow neck. But it was of absolutely no use to them, even if they could have descended the perpendicular headlands below them. There was no shoreline along which they might make their way. The glacier fell sheer into the sea. There was nothing to do but to retrace their steps, and they started back upland. The worst of it was that it cost them time. Given time, they could have probed and reconnoitred for the best route, resting when they felt the need and travelling only when they were fit and when the weather was best. But they had dared all for the sake of speed. They had neither sleeping bags nor tents, and if they were caught in these mountains by a change of weather, they would be powerless to save themselves. The blizzards of South Georgia are considered among the worst on earth. It took 2 toilsome hours to regain the ground they had lost, and then they set off again toward the east. By 8:30 they saw that a range of small mountains lay ahead, a series of ridges and spurs, 4 altogether like the knuckles of a tightly clenched fist. Worsley figured that their route lay closest between the first and the second, and they set their course in that direction. From here the ascent became increasingly steep, and they laboured upward, 1 foot at a time, with Shackleton in the lead. They climbed what seemed to be an almost vertical slope, cutting steps in its face with the adze. Finally, they gained the summit. Shackleton was the first to peer over. He saw beneath him a precipitous drop, ending in a chasm 1,500 feet below. It was strewn with the shattered fragments of ice that had plunged from where he crouched. He waved for the others to come and see for themselves. There was no way down. Furthermore, to the right lay a chaotic mass of ice cliffs and crevasses, impossible territory. To the left was a steeply descending line of glaciers dropping away into the sea, but dead ahead, the direction in which their course lay, was a gently rising snow slope, stretching away for perhaps 8 miles. It was this they had to reach, if only they could get down to it. It had taken more than 3 hours of strenuous effort to reach the summit, but now the only thing to do was to retreat, to retrace their steps again, and try to find a different way, perhaps around the second peak. They granted themselves 5 minutes' rest, then started down the way they had come. Physically, the descent was relatively easy and took only an hour, but it was a disheartening business. When they reached the bottom, they skirted around the base of the mountain, making their way between the overhanging ice cliffs and a truly gigantic bergschrund, a crescent-shaped gully, 1,000 feet deep and 1.5 miles long, cut out by the wind. They paused at 12:30 to have another ration of hoosh, and then they started up again. It was a tortuous climb, much steeper than the first, and they had to cut steps with the adze, beginning halfway up the face of the slope. The height and the exertion were a terrible strain, and they found it impossible to keep going steadily. Every 20 minutes or so they sprawled on their backs, with their legs and arms flung out, sucking in great gulps of the rarefied air. But finally, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they were in sight of the ridge, a cap of blue-white ice. The view from the top revealed the descent to be every bit as frighteningly impossible as the first had been. Only this time there was an added menace. The afternoon was getting on, and heavy banks of fog were beginning to form in the valley far below. Looking back, they saw more rolling in from the west. Their situation was starkly simple. Unless they could get lower, they would freeze to death. Shackleton estimated their altitude at 4,500 feet. At such a height, the temperature at night might easily drop well below zero. They had no means for obtaining shelter, and their clothes were worn and thin. Hurriedly, Shackleton turned and started down again with the others following. This time he did his best to keep as high as possible, cutting steps in the slope and working laterally around the side of the third peak, then up again once more. They moved as quickly as they could, but there was very little speed left in them. Their legs were wobbly and strangely disobedient. Finally, well after 4 o'clock, they struggled to the top. The ridge was so sharp that Shackleton was able to sit astride it, one leg on either side. The light was fading fast, but peering warily down, he saw that though the descent was steep, it was not so bad as the others had been. Toward the bottom, it appeared to slope away toward level ground. But there was no telling for sure, because the valley now was thick with fog, and the light was very poor. Furthermore, the fog, creeping up behind them, was approaching very rapidly, threatening to obliterate everything, leaving them blinded and trapped atop this razorback. The time for hesitation was past. Shackleton swung himself over the side. Working furiously, he began to cut steps in the face of the cliff, descending slowly a foot at a time. A bitter chill had come into the air, and the sun was nearly down. Gradually they were getting lower, but it was maddeningly slow progress. After 30 minutes, the ice-hard surface of the snow grew softer, indicating that the grade was not quite so steep. Shackleton stopped short. He seemed to realise all at once the futility of what he was doing. At the rate they were going, it would take hours to make the descent. Furthermore, it was probably too late to turn back. He hacked out a small platform with the adze, then called to the others to come down. There was no need to explain the situation. Speaking rapidly, Shackleton said simply that they faced a clear-cut choice. If they stayed where they were, they would freeze. In an hour, maybe two, maybe more. They had to get lower, and with all possible haste. So he suggested they slide. Worsley and Crean were stunned. But Shackleton wasn't joking. He wasn't even smiling. He meant it, and they knew it. And so the decision was made. Shackleton said they would slide as a unit, holding on to one another. Worsley locked his legs around Shackleton's waist and put his arms around Shackleton's neck. Crean did the same with Worsley. They looked like three tobogganers, without a toboggan. Shackleton did not permit any time for reflection. When they were ready, he kicked off. In the next instant, their hearts stopped beating. They seemed to hang, poised for a split second. Then, suddenly, the wind was shrieking in their ears, and a white blur of snow tore past. Down, down. They screamed, not in terror necessarily, but simply because they couldn't help it. It was squeezed out of them by the rapidly mounting pressure in their ears and against their chests. Then they shot forward, onto the level, and their speed began to slacken. A moment later, they came to an abrupt halt in a snowbank. The three men picked themselves up. They were breathless, and their hearts were beating wildly, but they found themselves laughing uncontrollably. What had been a terrifying prospect, possibly 100 seconds before, had turned into a breathtaking triumph. After a meal of biscuit and sledging ration, they started up the snowy slope toward the east. It was tricky going in the dark, and extreme caution was needed to watch for crevasses. They kept on until after midnight, stopping at intervals to rest, for their weariness was now becoming a real burden, relieved only by the knowledge that surely they were getting close. At about 12:30, they had reached a height of perhaps 4,000 feet, and the slope levelled off. Then, slowly, it started to descend, curving slightly toward the northeast, exactly as it should toward Stromness Bay. With great expectation, they turned to follow it down. For more than an hour they travelled downhill. Then they came in sight of the water once more. There, outlined by the moonlight, was Mutton Island, sitting in the middle of Stromness Bay. As they made their way along, other familiar landmarks came into view, and they excitedly pointed them out to one another. Within an hour or two, they would be down. but then Crean spotted a crevasse off to the right. And looking ahead, they saw other crevasses in their path. They stopped, confused. They were on a glacier. Only there were no glaciers surrounding Stromness Bay. They knew then that their own eagerness had cruelly deceived them. The island lying just ahead wasn't Mutton Island. The landmarks they had seen were the creations of their own imagination. Worsley took out the chart and the others gathered around him in the moonlight. They had descended to what must be Fortuna Bay, one of the many coastal indentations on South Georgia lying to the west of Stromness Bay. It meant that once more they had to retrace their steps. Bitterly disappointed, they turned and began to plod uphill again. For two miserable hours they kept at it, skirting the edge of Fortuna Bay and struggling to regain the ground they had lost. By 5 o'clock they had recovered most of it, and they came to another line of ridges, similar to the ones that had blocked their way the previous afternoon. Only this time there appeared to be a small pass. But they were tired now, to the point of exhaustion. They found a little sheltered spot behind a rock and sat down, huddled together with their arms around one another for warmth. Almost at once, Worsley and Crean fell asleep, and Shackleton, too, caught himself nodding. Suddenly, he jerked his head upright. All the years of Antarctic experience told him that this was the danger sign, the fatal sleep that trails off into freezing death. He fought to stay awake for 5 long minutes. Then he woke the others, telling them that they had slept for 30 minutes. Even after so brief a rest, their legs had stiffened so that it was actually painful to straighten them, and they were awkward when they moved off again. The gap through the ridges lay perhaps 1,000 feet above them, and they trudged toward it, silent with apprehension of what they would find on the other side. It was just 6 o'clock when they passed through, and the first light of dawn showed that no cliff, no precipice barred the way, only a comfortable grade so far as they could see. Beyond the valley, the high hills to the west of Stromness stood away in the distance. "It looks too good to be true," Worsley said. They started down. When they had descended to a height of about 2,500 feet, they paused to prepare breakfast. Worsley and Crean dug a hole for the Primus stove, while Shackleton went to see if he could learn what lay ahead. He climbed a small ridge by cutting steps in it. The view from the top was not altogether encouraging. The slope appeared to end in another precipice, though it was hard to tell for sure. He started down, and just then a sound reached him. It was faint and uncertain, but it could have been a steam whistle. Shackleton knew it was about 6:30 a.m., the time when the men at whaling stations usually were wakened. He hurried down from the ridge to tell Worsley and Crean the exciting news. Breakfast was gulped down. Then Worsley took the chronometer from around his neck, and the three of them crowded around, staring fixedly at its hands. If Shackleton had heard the steam whistle at Stromness, it should blow again to call the men to work at 7 o'clock. It was 6:50, then 6:55. They hardly even breathed for fear of making a sound. 6:58. 6:59. Exactly to the second, the hoot of the whistle carried through the thin morning air. They looked at one another and smiled. Then they shook hands without speaking. A peculiar thing to stir a man, the sound of a factory whistle heard on a mountainside. But for them, it was the first sound from the outside world that they had heard since December 1914, 17 unbelievable months before. In that instant, they felt an overwhelming sense of pride and accomplishment. Though they had failed dismally even to come close to the expedition's original objective, they knew now that somehow they had done much, much more than ever they set out to do. Shackleton now seemed possessed with urgency to get down, and though there was an obviously safer but longer route off to the left, he elected to press forward and risk the chance of a steep grade, and so they hurried forward, floundering through the deep snow. But 500 feet down, they discovered that Shackleton had indeed seen a precipice at the end of the slope, and it was terrifyingly steep, too, almost like a church steeple. But they were in no humour to turn back now. Shackleton was lowered over the edge, and he cut steps in the icy face of the cliff. When he'd reached the 50-foot limit of the rope, the other two descended to where he stood, and the cycle was repeated over again. It was progress, but slow and dangerous. It took them 3 full hours to make the descent. But finally, about 10 o'clock, they reached the bottom. From here, there was only an easy grade down into the valley, then up the other side. It was a long climb, however, nearly 3,000 feet in all, and they were very, very tired. But with only one more ridge to go, they drove their weary bodies upward. At noon, they were halfway there, and at 12:30 they reached a small plateau. Then at last, just at 1:30, they gained the final ridge and stood looking down. Spread out beneath them, 2,500 feet below, was Stromness Whaling Station. A sailing ship was tied up to one of the wharfs, and a small whale catcher was entering the bay. They saw the tiny figures of men moving around the docks and sheds. For a very long moment, they stared without speaking. There really didn't seem to be very much to say, or at least anything that needed to be said. "Let's go down," Shackleton said quietly. Having got so close, his old familiar caution returned, and he was determined that nothing was to go wrong now. The terrain below demanded caution. It was a severe ice-covered grade like the sides of a bowl sloping in all directions down toward the harbour. If a man lost his footing, he might plunge the entire distance, for there was almost nothing to get hold of. They worked along the top of the ridge until they found a small ravine, which appeared to offer a footing, and they started down. After about an hour, the sides of the ravine were getting steeper, and a small stream flowed down the centre. As they made their way along, the stream increased in depth until they were wading through knee-deep water that was frigidly cold from the snowy uplands that fed it. About 3 o'clock, they looked ahead and saw that the stream ended, abruptly, in a waterfall. They reached the edge and leaned over. There was a drop of about 25 feet. But it was the only way. There was nothing to do but to go over the edge. With some trouble, they found a boulder large enough to hold their weight, and they made one end of the rope fast to it. All three of them pulled off their Burberries, in which they wrapped the ads, the cookpot, and Worsley's diary, then pitched them over the side. Crean was the first to go down. Shackleton and Worsley lowered him, and he reached the bottom, gasping and choking. Then Shackleton lowered himself down through the water. Worsley was last. It was an icy ducking, but they were at the bottom, and from here the ground was almost level. The rope could not be recovered, but they picked up the 3 articles that remained and started off for the station, now only a mile or so away. Matthias Anderson was the station foreman at Stromness. He had never met Shackleton, but along with everyone else at South Georgia, he knew that the Endurance had sailed from there in 1914 and had undoubtedly been lost with all hands in the Weddell Sea. Just then, however, his thoughts were a long way from Shackleton and the ill-fated Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. He had put in a long work day, and it was now after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he was tired. He was standing on the dock, supervising a group of his men who were unloading supplies from a boat. Just then he heard an outcry and looked up. 2 small boys, about 11 years old, were running. Behind them, Anderson saw the figures of 3 men, walking slowly and with great weariness in his direction. He was puzzled. They were strangers, certainly, but that was not so unusual as the fact that they were coming not from the docks where a ship might come in, but from the direction of the mountains. the interior of the island. As they drew closer, he saw that they were heavily bearded, and their faces were almost black except for their eyes. Their hair was as long as a woman's, and hung down almost to their shoulders. For some reason, it looked stringy and stiff. Their clothing was peculiar, too. It was not the sweaters and boots worn by seamen. Instead, the three men appeared to have on parkas, though it was hard to tell because their garments were in such a ragged state. The foreman stepped forward to meet them. The man in the centre spoke in English. "Would you please take us to Anton Andersen?" The foreman shook his head. Anton Andersen was not at Stromness any longer, he explained. He had been replaced by the regular factory manager, Thoralf Sörle. The Englishman seemed pleased. "Good," he said. "I know Sörle well." The foreman led the way to Sörle's house, about 100 yards off to the right. Almost all the workmen on the pier had left their jobs to come see the three strangers who had appeared at the dock. Now they lined the route, looking curiously at the foreman and his three companions. Anderson knocked at the manager's door, and after a moment Sörle himself opened it. When he saw the three men, he stepped back, and a look of disbelief came over his face. For a long moment he stood shocked and silent before he spoke. "Who the hell are you?" he said at last. The man in the centre stepped forward. "My name is Shackleton," he replied in a quiet voice. Again there was silence. Some said that Sörle turned away and wept. Every comfort the whaling station could provide was placed at the disposal of Shackleton, Worsley and Crean. They first enjoyed the glorious luxury of a long bath, followed by a shave. Then new clothes were given them from the station storehouse. That night, after a hearty dinner, Worsley went on board the whale catcher Samson for the trip around South Georgia to Peggotty Camp, where MacNeish, McCarthy and Vincent were waiting. Very little is known about the meeting, except that the three castaways at first failed to recognise Worsley, because his appearance was so drastically altered now that he was shaved and had on fresh clothes. MacNeish, McCarthy and Vincent were taken on board the whale catcher, and the care too was loaded. The Samson arrived back at Stromness the following day, May the 22nd. Shackleton, meanwhile, had arranged for the use of a large wooden whaler, the Southern Sky, in which to return to Elephant Island for the relief of the party there. That evening, a sort of crude reception was held in what Worsley described as a large room full of captains and mates and sailors and hazy with tobacco smoke. Four white-haired veteran Norwegian skippers came forward. Their spokesman, speaking in Norse with Sörle translating, said that they had sailed the Antarctic seas for 40 years, and that they wanted to shake the hands of the men who could bring an open 22-foot boat from Elephant Island through the Drake Passage to South Georgia. There was no formality, no speeches. They had no medals or decorations to bestow, only their heartfelt admiration for an accomplishment which perhaps only they would ever fully appreciate. Of the honours that followed, and there were many, possibly none ever exceeded that night of May the 22nd, 1916, when, in a dingy warehouse shack on South Georgia, the whalermen of the Southern Ocean stepped forward, one by one, and silently shook hands with Shackleton, Worsley and Crean. The following morning, Shackleton and his two companions set out for Elephant Island. It was the beginning of a maddeningly frustrating series of rescue attempts, lasting more than 3 months, during which the pack ice surrounding Elephant Island seemed resolutely determined that no rescue ship would get through to relieve the castaways. The Southern Sky encountered ice only 3 days out from South Georgia, and less than a week later she was forced to return to port. Within 10 days, however, Shackleton had obtained from the Uruguayan government the loan of a small survey vessel for a second attempt to rescue his men. She limped home 6 days later, severely damaged by the ice through which Shackleton had tried to push her. a third attempt was made in a bulky wooden schooner, the Emma, which Shackleton chartered. She was at sea for nearly 3 weeks, during which it was a struggle merely to keep her afloat, much less to effect a rescue. The Emma never approached Elephant Island closer than 100 miles. It was now August the 3rd, nearly 3.5 months since the Caird had sailed for South Georgia. Throughout each failure of the subsequent rescue attempts, Shackleton's anxiety had risen to the extent that Worsley said he had never seen him so on edge. He had consistently appealed to the government back in England to send a proper ice vessel to get through the pack. Now word came that the Discovery, which had originally carried Scott to the Antarctic in 1901, was finally on her way from England. But it would take weeks for her to arrive, and Shackleton was in no mood to sit idly by and wait. Instead, he appealed to the Chilean government for the use of an ancient seagoing tug, the Yelcho. He promised not to take her into any ice, for she was steel-hulled, and her ability to weather the sea, much less any pack, was doubtful. The request was granted, and the Yelcho sailed on August the 25th. This time, the fates were willing. For the 22 castaways on Elephant Island, August the 30th began like almost any other day. At sunrise, the weather was clear and cold, giving promise of a fine day. But before long, heavy clouds rolled in, and the scene once more became, as Ord Lees recorded, the prevailing gloom to which we are now so inured. As always, almost everyone tramped individually to the top of the lookout bluff to satisfy himself once more that there was no ship to be seen. By now they did so more out of habit than of hope. It was simply a ritual to which they had become accustomed, and they climbed the bluff without anticipation and returned to the hut without disappointment. It had been 4 months and 6 days since the Caird had left, and there was not a man among them who still believed seriously that she had survived the journey to South Georgia. It was now only a matter of time until a party was sent in the Wills on the perilous journey to Deception Island. Wally Howe was acting as cook, and he was preparing a lunch of boiled seal's backbone, a dish of which everyone had become extremely fond. The hoosh was ready about 12:45, and they all gathered in the hut, except Marston, who had gone to the lookout bluff to make some thumbnail sketches. A few minutes later, they heard his footsteps running along the path, but nobody paid much attention. He was simply late for lunch. Then he put his head inside and spoke to Wilde in a tone so breathless that some of the men thought he sounded casual. "Hadn't we better send up some smoke signals?" he asked. For a moment there was silence, and then, as one man, they grasped what Marston was saying. Before there was time for a reply, Ord Lees recorded, "There was a rush of members tumbling over one another, all mixed up with mugs of seal hoosh, making a simultaneous dive for the door hole, which was immediately torn to shreds, so that those members who could not pass through it on account of the crush made their exits through the wall, or what remained of it. Some put their boots on, others didn't bother. James put his on the wrong feet." Sure enough, there was a small ship, only about a mile offshore. Macklin dashed to the lookout bluff, tearing off his Burberry jacket as he ran. There he tied it onto the halyard of the oar that served as their flagpole. Hurley gathered up all the sennegrass he could find, then poured over it some blubber oil and the 2 gallons of paraffin they still had. He had a hard time lighting it, and when it finally ignited, almost with an explosion, it produced more flame than smoke. But no matter, the ship was headed toward the spit. Wilde, meanwhile, had gone to the water's edge and was signalling from there the best place to send in a boat. Macklin returned to the hut and lifted Blackborough to his shoulders, then carried him to a position on the rocks near Wilde, where he might better see the thrilling sight. The ship approached to within several hundred yards, then stopped. The men ashore could see a boat being lowered. 4 men got into it, followed by the sturdy, square-set figure they knew so well. Shackleton. A spontaneous cheer went up. In fact, the excitement ashore was so intense that many men actually were giggling. Within a few minutes, the boat was near enough for Shackleton to be heard. "Are you all right?" he shouted. "All well!" they replied. Wild guided the boat to a safe place among the rocks, but because of the ice around the spit, it was impossible to make a landing, so the boat was held a few feet off. Wild urged Shackleton to come ashore, if only briefly, to see how they had fixed the hut in which they had waited 4 long months, but Shackleton, though he was smiling and obviously relieved, was still quite noticeably anxious and wanted only to be away. He declined Wild's offer and urged the men to get on board as quickly as possible. Certainly no great urging was needed, and one at a time they jumped from the rocks into the boat, leaving behind them, without a second thought, dozens of personal little items, which only an hour before had been considered almost indispensable. One load was rowed out to the Yelcho, and then a second. Throughout it all, Worsley had watched anxiously from the bridge of the ship. Finally he logged, 2:10, all well, at last. 2:15, full speed ahead. Macklin wrote, I stayed on deck to watch Elephant Island recede in the distance. I could still see my Burberry jacket flapping in the breeze on the hillside. No doubt, it will flap there to the wonderment of gulls and penguins, till one of our familiar gales blows it all to ribbons.
Production copyright 2002. All rights reserved. Listeners may enjoy another outstanding true adventure story from the audio partners. Touch the Top of the World by blind mountain climber Eric Weinmayer, read by Nick Sullivan. For a free audio editions catalog offering thousands of audiobooks on cassette and compact disc from all major publishers, call toll-free 1-800-231-4261. Visit our website at www.audioeditions.com.